California Dreaming is brought to you by Blueberry. You know that there is a little bit more to making a podcast than talking into a mic and hitting publish. You need a little bit more than that. And I'm talking about a reliable hosting service so your time can be spent working on your show. You also want accurate download numbers, you want to see the audience that you're reaching, and you're going to want a webpage that's simple and easy to work with. That's why I use Blueberry. With its simple media hosting and a fully integrated WordPress website, it can't get any easier. If you host a show or you're thinking about starting one, visit www.orbitaljigsaw.com/stream to give Blueberry a try for a month for free. Blueberry's support team will be right there with you every step of the way to help you migrate over. You won't lose any of your subscribers in the process either. And if you're new to this, they can get your show up and running. And with a month for free to try it out using promo code DREAM, what have you got to lose? This episode of California Dreaming contains details involving graphic violence and sexual assault and is not suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion is strongly advised. November 20th is generally a nondescript date for the most part. It has been a special day for me and my family, though. November 20th, 2019 would have been my dad's 95th birthday, and I always think about him on that date, as he's been gone now for more than 12 years. A dozen November 20ths have come and gone. A dozen times I've quietly wished my dad a happy birthday. But this past weekend, my dreamers reached out to me and told me about a thing that is happening next month, on this upcoming November 20th. A potential travesty of justice that many, many people are rallying to try and make right before it's too late. It is potentially one of the most tragic things that can possibly happen in our justice system. On November 20th, 2019, a man named Rodney Reed is scheduled to die by lethal injection in Texas for the April 23rd, 1996 murder of Stacy Stites, a murder that he insists he did not commit. And lots of people believe in his innocence and are making every legal maneuver available to halt his execution, even some members of the victim's own family. Now, granted, this case has garnered a great deal of media attention. It has been featured on numerous podcasts and TV shows. There are several documentaries out there on YouTube, and even Dr. Phil is on Rodney's side here. And even though this case is outside of California, my dreamers expressed their passion and concern for the injustice they feel is happening and asked me if I could share Rodney's story anyway, because if he is truly innocent of the crime for which he's been convicted, and if he is put to death for it next month, it impacts us all. So it's a case you may have heard of a handful of times already, but there are always the few who have not heard it at all. So just as we did our recent multi-part series involving Kevin Cooper, we are going to try and comb through the details of the case against Rodney Reed. I can't say yet how many parts this is going to be. I'm aiming for 3, but I won't limit us to just that in case it takes more time to get through it all. But unlike Kevin Cooper, Rodney's days are numbered, and it is imperative that we get this out there in a timely manner. So without further ado, let's delve into this multi-part vacation series of California Dreaming, the tale of who killed Stacy Stites. In 1995, following her graduation from high school, Stacy Stites moved with her mother, Carol, from Smithville, Texas, to the city of Bastrop, which is about 30 miles or 48 kilometers southeast of Austin. Stacy first found work at a Bastrop car dealership, but in October of 1995, took a job cashiering at the Bastrop HEB, which is a grocery store that is only found in the state of Texas and northeastern Mexico. In January of 1996, Stacy and Carol moved again to the nearby town of Giddings, which is where the man Stacy was engaged to, Jimmy Fennell, lived and worked as a patrol officer with the Giddings Police Department. At the time, he was about 3 to 4 years older than Stacy. I looked around for a date of birth, but the closest I could find was that he was born in 1973. Fennell had graduated from the police academy in October of 1995 and was hired on with the Giddings Police Department 2 months later in December. For Fennell, it had been a long-standing goal of his to one day work in law enforcement. Prior to joining the force, he had previously worked as a jailer for the Bastrop County Sheriff's Department. Stacy had met Fennell in May of 1995 at the Smithfield Jamboree, an annual festival with carnival rides, food booths, live music, and livestock. According to Stacy's mom, she and Fennell were pretty much inseparable after they began dating a few weeks after the Jamboree, and within about 6 months, they were engaged. So the three of them, Stacy, her fiancé, and her mom, all moved into an apartment that was located just outside of Giddings. Stacy and Fennell shared an upstairs unit on the second floor, and Carol lived in her own one-bedroom unit on the first floor. Stacy and her mom had a close relationship, so it was important to both of them that they didn't live too far away from one another. So Stacy and Jimmy Fennell were looking forward to their wedding, which was set to be a pretty major event scheduled to take place at a local church on Saturday, May 11th, 1996. In order to offset the wedding expenses, Stacy decided to transfer from cashiering and bagging to working in the HEB's produce department. This position would include an increase in her rate of pay, but it also involved a change in hours. Her shift would now begin at 3:30 in the morning prior to the store's business hours to stock the fresh produce for the day. Obviously, there are no HEB stores in California. I hadn't even heard of the place until this episode. And even when we went to Texas, I didn't even see an HEB. I mostly went to Walmart, but I wish I had. I went online to check if HEB was a 24-hour place, and it is not. Store hours vary by location, anywhere from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. or 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. So yes, Stacy would have to be there before the store opened for business for the day. According to court documents, it's been reported that Stacy got up sometime between 2:45 and 2:50 in the morning, and it said it took her anywhere between 5 and 20 minutes to get ready. Now, the drive to the Bastrop HEB was a drive that took 25 to 30 minutes. She had to be there at 3:30, so to me, waking up at 2:45 is cutting it pretty close. And when she would leave for work, her uniform typically would be a pair of blue pants and a red shirt with the HEB insignia on the front. She usually wore a white t-shirt and carried her red HEB shirt with her and put it on later, either when she got to work or when the store opened, which would make sense. If Stacy is stocking produce, it could be kind of messy, and if she had to be working once HEB opened for business, she would be able to put on a fresh shirt. And she always brought something to drink with her, either juice or water. Stacy had a choice of vehicles to make the drive to HEB. Either her mom's car, which is a light-colored Ford Tempo, or she would take Fennell's red Chevy S10 extended cab pickup truck. She usually drove Fennell's truck because her mom's car was not as reliable and had broken down on her way to work in the past. And this is a Ford Tempo we're talking about, so yeah, that makes total sense. It's not the greatest car in the world. So she opted to take Fennell's truck most of the time. I guess she didn't have a car of her own yet, but it does not seem that it was a pressing matter. She could use either her mom's or Fennell's vehicle, since he was a cop and drove his patrol car for work. If Stacy took his truck, then he would use Carol's Ford Tempo to go to work, as it was considerably closer. After her shift ended, sometime in the early afternoon, and we're talking an 8-hour day plus a lunch, so roughly 12:30 in the afternoon, Stacy would go home. She would typically go to her mom's apartment, take a nap there, and when she got up, she and her mom would get busy preparing for the wedding. So on Monday, April 22nd, 1996, 19 days until the wedding, It had been a typical workday for Stacy. She had arrived at her mom's apartment early in the afternoon after her shift per usual. She had lunch and laid down for a nap. Fennell arrived home a few hours later. He stopped in Carol's apartment to give her back the extra set of keys that he had borrowed in order to take her car to work that day. Those keys were an extra set that Carol referred to as Stacy's keys, which she kept on a shelf in her apartment. And this is where Fennell left them. The three of them discussed their plans for the following day. As usual, Stacy was scheduled to be at work at 3:30 in the morning. However, Fennell had the day off. Stacy and Fennell made plans to visit their insurance agent and go to the florist to choose arrangements for the upcoming wedding when she got off work the following afternoon of April 23rd. During the course of their conversation about their plans for the next day, Fennell offered to drive Stacy to work. Carol jumped in and suggested that perhaps he wanted to sleep in since he was off that day. When Stacy's shift was over, she could drive him to Bastrop so he could meet up with Stacy to run their errands. Fennell turned the offer down and said he would get up early with Stacy and drive her to work himself. Following this conversation, Fennell left in his truck as he coached a Little League baseball team with a friend and co-worker named Officer David Hall. Fennell returned to the apartment sometime between 8 and 8:30 p.m. Carol and Stacy met him outside, and she reported that the two of them ran up the stairs laughing, in her words, as hard as they could. According to Fennell, when they got back up to their apartment, they showered together, and he said that they did not have sexual intercourse. He explained that Stacy was at the time taking birth control pills, and at that point in her prescription cycle, the vitamin pills that she was taking increased her chances of getting pregnant. So according to him, they did not have sex. They also renewed their discussion about their plans in the morning, and they decided to go ahead and take Carol up on her offer to drive him to Bastrop the following day when Stacy got off work so that he could sleep in. Stacy would take Fennell's truck to work instead of him taking her. And according to Fennell, Stacy went to sleep at 9 p.m. and he stayed up to watch the news. Okay, dreamers, so up to this point, we know that the last time Stacy was seen by her mother was sometime between 8 and 8:30 when she ran upstairs with Fennell for the night. Fennell said that she went to sleep around 9. She needed to be up by 2:45 or 2:50 the next morning, so that would give her a little less than 6 hours of sleep. She needed to be at work by 3:30 that morning, but Stacy never made it. So now we're at Tuesday, April 23rd, 1996. Stacy's co-worker, Andrew Cardenas, he also worked in the produce department with her at HEB, he arrived for his shift at approximately 3:30 that morning, and he waited in the parking lot for Stacy to arrive as they would go in together. He has said that he always waited for Stacy in his car so they could go in together and keep an eye on one another and make sure nobody was around when they walked into the store. And for the time that he had been working this shift with Stacy, she had always been a dependable and punctual person. So when she did not show up for work that morning, he immediately became concerned. He waited for a few more minutes past 3:30, but he eventually went inside to begin his shift. But he reported that he kept an eye out for Stacy in case she pulled up. A little under 2 hours later, at 5:23 a.m., Officer Paul Alexander with the Bastrop Sheriff's Department was out on his routine patrol of the area when he spotted a red Chevy S10 extended cab pickup parked in the Bastrop High School parking lot. Officer Alexander regularly passes by the high school in these early morning hours, and he had not seen this truck parked there that early at school before, and there were no other cars in the parking lot yet. If this is your typical high school, what time would we say that school administrators and staff start showing up for their work day? Maybe 6:45 or 7 in the morning? Some teachers like to get there early to prepare for the day. I get that. But Officer Alexander would have probably recognized the vehicles that showed up early, and this truck was not one of them. So Officer Alexander radioed the dispatcher and asked to run a check on the license plates to see if they happened to come out stolen. The dispatcher told him that it was not stolen and that it was registered to someone with the last name of Fennell. Now, Officer Alexander, he did know Jimmy Fennell, but only to an extent. He did not know him well, and he did not make the connection between the vehicle registered to Fennell and to the Fennell he knew to be an officer with the Giddings Police Department. Officer Alexander approached the car to take a look inside the cab with his flashlight. The driver's seat had been reclined, and on the seat were some books and clothing. On the ground, on the driver's side, near the door, he noticed a small piece of a broken belt buckle. But because there was no shattered glass and the ignition did not appear to have been tampered with, and the driver's side door was locked, he figured that nothing really serious was going on with this truck and went about his patrol. Back at AGB, Andrew had been going on about his shift, still waiting for Stacy to arrive at work. It was approaching the time for the store to open, and there was still no sign of her, and no one had called into the store to report that she wouldn't be coming in. So he decided to call Stacy's mom sometime between 6:30 and 7 in the morning. As soon as Andrew told Carol that her daughter had failed to show up for work, she immediately became worried and upset and apparently shouted Jimmy Fennell's name in order to get his attention. Andrew hung up with Carol, at which time she called Fennell upstairs to wake him up. He answered the phone and she told him that she just got a call from HEB and was told that Stacy failed to show up for work. Fennell hurried down the stairs to Carol's apartment. He instructed Carol to call law enforcement and inform them that Stacy was missing and he was out looking for her. Carol was in possession of both sets of keys to her Ford Tempo. So Fennell took Stacy's set and drove in the direction of the Bastrop HEB, looking for any sign of Stacy or his truck. He did not find either one. At the same time, the Bastrop Police Department sent officers out also to look for Stacy and the truck, and an investigator with the Bastrop Police Department named David Board contacted Carol, who was still back at her apartment, to assure her that they were doing everything they could to find her daughter. At approximately 9 a.m., 2 hours after Carol and Fennell were made aware that Stacy had not shown up for work, after authorities in the area had received the report that Stacy was missing, another investigator with the Bastrop Police Department named Ed Selmala was dispatched to the Bastrop High School parking lot. I am assuming that when Stacy was reported missing, the truck's information was provided along with the report, and when that was entered into the system, they got a hit on Officer Alexander's earlier call to run the truck's plates, which prompted Ed Selmala to be sent out there to investigate. When he arrived at the high school, he radioed the other officers and investigators the truck's location and requested assistance at the scene. Several investigators with the Bastrop Police Department, as well as the Sheriff's Department, arrived and began taking pictures of the truck, as well as several other pieces of evidence. Officer Alexander, the one who was asked for the plates to be ran earlier that morning, had already gone home for the day. He was asked to come back to the scene to explain the reasons why he asked for the plates to be ran, as well as provide a report for the investigation. The truck was towed from the high school and first taken to a local toll shop, and it would be held until it could be transported to the Texas Department of Public Safety, or the DPS, crime lab, located in Austin, where its lab and forensic experts could process the truck for evidence. It kind of sounded weird to me that the truck was taken to a tow shop. I would hope the truck and everything about it was secured and protected properly while it was at the tow shop. It did not say that it was taken to the police impound yard. It said to a tow shop, which I found a little troubling even this early on in the investigation. So while the truck was being stored at the tow shop in Bastrop, investigators asked Fennell if he would come down and identify some of the items found inside and outside the truck. He was given very strict instructions to not touch anything at all and to look inside the cab of the truck to see if he could identify anything that wasn't supposed to be in the vehicle. Fennell noted a number of things in the truck that he described as being out of the ordinary. First, one tennis shoe that belonged to Stacy that she normally wore to work was laying on the floorboard of the passenger side of the truck. Second, there was what has been described as a foamy substance that appeared to be saliva on the carpet covering the hump over the truck's transmission. I'm assuming that this hump is located in the center of the vehicle, separating the driver's side floorboard and the passenger side floorboard. Third, there were some broken pieces of green plastic in the center console consistent with the color and type of cup Stacy would normally bring that contained her water or juice that we discussed earlier. Fourth, the driver's seat was laid back at a 45-degree angle. Fifth, the driver's seatbelt was still buckled. And sixth, there was a large smudge on the back window of the passenger side. Fennell was also able to identify several items that were found outside the truck. First, there were carbon copies of checks from his checkbook. Second, he identified that small piece of belt with a buckle attached as part of the belt that Stacy normally wore to work. Those were the only two items found outside the truck in the parking lot of the high school. When Fennell was finished identifying all of the items related to the truck, he went back to his apartment. When the truck was finally brought to the DPS crime lab in Austin, this was still the same day, Tuesday, April 23rd, but I'm not clear as to what time the truck was brought to the lab and what time technicians began processing it for evidence. However, the examination of the truck came to a halt when the crime lab received word that Stacy's body had been discovered. The discovery of her body was made by a man named Kenneth Osborne just before 3 p.m. According to court documents, Stacy was found on Blue Bonnet Drive off of FM 1441, which is just a road. I looked at maps to get an idea of what this area looks like. Okay, so where the truck was found at Bastrop High School was not too far away from the HEB where Stacy worked, and I believe it was about 7 miles away from where her body was found. Coming from where they lived in Giddings, the crime scene that would have been passed first would have been where the body was dumped on Blue Bonnet Drive. So if we assume that Stacy left her home in the truck, whether on her own or not, we presume that the first stop along the route to Bastrop would be where the body was dumped on Blue Bonnet. Taking the highway in this direction from Giddings towards Bastrop, it would be a turnoff several miles northeast of her work where she was found. The next closest crime scene would be Bastrop High, which, going along her route to work, would be arrived at without passing HEB, as that would be a little ways further west and south of the high school. The truck was left there, and whoever left the truck departed from the scene by some other means. Now, Dreamers, we're not going to narrow down the time frame quite yet, as we need to discuss the condition of Stacy's body first. But all of this had to have happened sometime between approximately 9 p.m. the evening before and 5:23 in the morning when Officer Alexander called in the truck's plates. I couldn't find any information as to whether or not he felt the hood of the car to determine if it was still warm. So for right now, we know that sometime in that 8-hour window of time, Stacy was murdered. We will try to narrow that down, but it's going to be a challenge. Okay, so just before 3 p.m. on April 23rd, the man named Kenneth Osborne, a real estate appraiser, had arrived near the area for a 3 o'clock appointment, a little bit early. So he decided to take a turn on Blue Bonnet Drive, a drive that encircles Lake Bastrop. So I imagine it's somewhat of a scenic drive, and someone in the Facebook group pointed out that it is rural as well. On maps, it looks very lush and green. So Kenneth's intentions were to pick some flowers for his wife, and that is when he happened upon Stacy's lifeless body. She was off the side of the road in a ditch surrounded by some thorny bushes. It wasn't until he got closer to her that he realized that she was dead. He went back to his car, stopped at the nearest house, and asked to use the phone to call police to report that he had found a body. He then returned to Bluebonnet Road to wait for the police to arrive. One of the first officers on the scene was an investigator with the Bastrop Police Department named John Barton. He made the decision to cover Stacy's body with a green blanket to prevent people, the media, and helicopters and whatever other prying eyes there would be from seeing the condition in which Stacy had been left. And this is another troubling thing in a long list of troubling things that would go on with the investigation into Stacy's death. Maybe it wasn't something that was a part of the training, but of course today, some 23 years after the fact, we know that it is a huge blunder to place a random blanket over a dead body. So much evidence contamination is likely going to happen because of this, and it's not even clear where this blanket came from, most likely from the officer's own vehicle. We just know that all this contamination is now happening. This officer's intentions may have been in the right place, but it was a huge mistake, and this is only the beginning. Soon, other Bastrop investigators arrived at the scene, along with Texas Ranger LT Wardlow, who would eventually become the lead investigator assigned to the case to work in tandem with the Bastrop Police and the Sheriff's Department. Ranger Wardlow summoned the DPS Crime Lab technicians to the scene, at which time their work on processing Fennell's truck was halted. The DPS crime scene analyst from Austin arrived on Bluebonnet Drive at approximately 5:15 p.m. The person in charge of the lab team was designated by Wilson Young to be Karen Blakely, a specialist in DNA and serology. With her was a trace evidence analyst, a photographer, a latent print examiner, and a DNA and serology trainee working under her. Blakely first made note of the condition of Stacy's body. She noticed Stacy was missing one shoe, and the white sock she was wearing was clean, indicating that she did not walk anywhere outdoors. Remember, the other shoe was found on the floorboard of Fennell's truck. Stacy's HEB name tag was found cradled in the crook of her knee, where her leg was bent. I assume her name tag would normally be attached to her work shirt in some way, but that wasn't the case here. It was not attached to anything. It was just placed there in the bend of her knee. And it is the opinion of some, and I agree with this opinion, that the name tag was planted there on purpose to make it appear that she was headed to work at the time that she was attacked and murdered. Stacy was found on her back, and her arms were in this kind of awkward position above her head, like her arms were raised. Her legs were both bent, and in an article I read on this, it described her body as twisted, which is a very good way to describe this. There was a white t-shirt that was sort of balled up or crumpled up, and described as being tossed aside or strewn over some brush close to Stacy's body. Jimmy Fennell later identified this shirt as belonging to him. Stacy was not wearing the shirt, but remember, it was reported that she did wear a white shirt under her HEB work shirt, and it is likely she used one of Fennell's t-shirts regularly as that undershirt. We've all worn our significant other's t-shirts now and then. It's not an uncommon practice. When Stacy was discovered, she was wearing a black bra, a pair of blue jeans with a broken zipper, and a pair of green underwear. The underwear were visible from the position that she was in, with the zipper broken, and appeared to be somewhat bunched up around the hips. Upon closer inspection, it was discovered that the crotch area of her underwear was wet. Karen Blakely viewed the condition of Stacy's clothing as being indicative of her having been sexually assaulted, so she collected swab samples from Stacy's vaginal area as well as her breasts. Subsequent testing of the vaginal swabs for the presence of semen was conducted, and the results yielded a positive result. Rigor mortis had already set in, so Blakely was unable to make any determination as to whether or not Stacy had been sodomized. She reported that she would not have been able to swab the anal area without possibly causing further damage or injuries that could make it appear as though Stacy had suffered an event that actually had not taken place. Rigor being present at this point is not really going to be able to narrow down the timeline of Stacy's death, because at the time she was being examined, it was more than 12 hours after the truck had been discovered in the parking lot. And we can presume that she was already dead by that time, which was 5:23 in the morning. And rigor can last for as long as 3 days. But there are other things going on with Stacy's body post-mortem that will throw into question the timing of her death. And we will get into that information a little bit later on, because I really do want to narrow down the window for Stacy's time of death. And I will say this right now, dreamers, don't yet jump to the conclusion that Stacy was sexually assaulted despite the condition of her clothing. There are lots of things that are going to throw that determination into question. So Karen Blakely also noted that it was evident that a tremendous amount of force had been applied around Stacy's neck. There was a deep red indentation into her skin, and based on the pattern of that indentation, it appeared to match the woven pattern of the belt that was found near Stacy's body. And that belt is reported to have belonged to her. The belt found with her body, as well as the piece of belt and buckle found outside the driver's side door of the truck at the high school, when compared, did match. It was also determined that the belt came apart forcibly, meaning it had been torn into two pieces, not cut. When it came to additional injuries Stacy sustained, it was observed by Blakely that she had some scratches on her abdomen and arms, a burn from a cigarette on her arm, and some shallow wounds on her wrist and back, but those appear to have been caused by fire ants biting her skin. Blakely also noted that there was a large amount of mucus that originated from Stacy's nose running down the side of her face and deposited into her hair. I found some reports that the cigarette burn on her arm was not noted at the scene where her body had been left, but was noted later on at the medical examiner's office. Now, at this point, I am not 100% certain that that claim is accurate, or if there is photographic proof that this injury appeared at a later time, I'm hoping to run across that someplace in these files. But if that is the case, then this is another troubling aspect of the evidence collection and documentation process involving Stacy's murder. The latent fingerprint examiner, Terry Sandifer, took into evidence two Busch beer cans that were located across the road from where Stacy's body was discovered. The cans were processed for fingerprints when she got back to the lab, but there were none that were suitable for lifting. DNA testing on these cans would take place at a later time, and we will go over that as we go along with this story. Once Karen Blakely was finished at the scene where Stacy's body was discovered, she headed back to the lab and arrived there around 11 p.m. She wanted to take a look at the vaginal swabs as soon as possible under the microscope. And when she did, she found that the swabs had collected sperm that were intact. That is, sperm with the heads and tails still attached. So to her, that meant Stacy had recent sexual activity. Now, Blakely based this conclusion on a study that determined that 26 hours is about the length of time that tails will remain on a sperm head inside the vaginal tract of a female. I looked around and I had a really hard time finding information regarding that study. Most of the articles discussed how long sperm can live inside the vaginal tract after ejaculation, but nothing that I could see where the tail separates from the body of the sperm. However, in some years down the line, Karen Blakely's findings would be challenged and found to be erroneous. Anyway, once Blakely found what she believed to be sperm that had been deposited sometime in the last 26 hours, she reported her findings to the lead investigator on the case, Ranger Wardlow, and he immediately saw this piece of evidence as being the smoking gun, so to speak. that Stacy was raped and killed, and the person to whom that sperm belonged was her killer. So essentially what this means is Stacy had sexual intercourse sometime prior to her death, and we don't exactly know yet when she died, but because of the findings of these intact spermatozoa, it was concluded that the sexual encounter was very recent. It was assumed that she was killed by the donor of the sperm, and since Fennell had said Stacy left for work at 3 a.m, she must have been attacked and raped and killed after that time. The last time Stacy was seen alive was by her mom running up the stairs to her apartment with Fennell at approximately 8:30 the evening before. Fennell did say that they showered, but she went to bed around 9 and they did not have sexual intercourse. So the theory is that when she got up and left for work in Fennell's truck, Stacy was somehow stopped by someone along the commute to work, assaulted, raped, strangled, transported, dumped, the truck abandoned, and the killer made his getaway, all before 5:23 in the morning, when Officer Alexander noticed the car in the high school. Assuming Stacy was headed to work and was making it on time, she would have been on the road by 3 a.m., so that leaves at most a window of about 2 hours for her killer to do everything on the list: encounter her on the road, stop her, gain control over her and her vehicle, rape her, strangle her, transport her further up the highway to Bluebonnet Drive, dump her and dump her belongings strewn about, drive further up the way to Bastrop High School, dump the vehicle and leave the scene. That is a lot to accomplish in 2 hours, and that is the maximum time we can allow based on the time Stacy would have been on the road and the time that her truck was spotted at the high school. Okay, so that is one possible timeline that we have thus far, and that is based on the story that Fennell has stuck to all these years, that Stacy went to bed, then he went to bed after he stayed up watching the news, and she got up and went to work around 3, and that's the last time he would have seen or heard from her. Texas Ranger Wardlow's investigation has pretty much landed on the theory that whomever that sperm belongs to is the person who killed Stacy, and that the motive for the killing was a sexual assault. Travis County Medical Examiner Dr. Robert Bayardo was the one who conducted the autopsy on Stacy the following afternoon, Wednesday, April 24th, 1996, beginning at 1:50 p.m. Dr. Bayardo would come to the conclusion that Stacy died on Tuesday morning, April 23rd, around 3 a.m, plus or minus a few hours. He made this determination partially based on the changes that happen to the body after a person dies, but some years later, he would be asked about how he came to this determination. And he said he came to those findings mostly based on Jimmy Fennell's report that Stacy had left the house at 3 a.m. So there is no science involved in that determination whatsoever. We're going to go over some of his findings, and we're going to revisit these as well as the story progresses. Dr. Bayardo found on Stacy's body that she had both pre-mortem and post-mortem injuries on her body. And the way that he tells the difference between the two is based on the absence of bleeding. Once the heart is no longer beating, there will be no more bleeding or bruising that happens. There was a burn on her body caused by a cigarette, and that, along with several scratches, occurred post-mortem. At least that was his opinion. Stacy's skull did not show any outward signs of injury. However, he did make note of several bruises that had the appearance of injuries sustained while being struck on the head with a fist. When he compared the injury patterns on Stacy's neck with the pieces of the webbed belt collected into evidence, he concluded that the belt was the murder weapon, and that Stacy died as a result of asphyxiation caused by strangulation, which takes about 4 minutes to cause someone to die, but the person will pass out within a minute or two. Now, the following information I did not find in the court documents, but rather in the Statesman. Stacy had been burned post-mortem in large splotches on her face, arms, breasts, and thighs. I did see these photos of these splotches. I didn't read anywhere that Karen Blakely or Dr. Bayardo made note of these blotches, but I do think I read one report somewhere that Karen Blakely identified these blotches as being a result of having been out in the sun. Dreamers, these blotches are not burns, and I will discuss them as we go along in the case, but they're very, very important to remember. There were also two hairs found on Stacy. One was never identified, and the other appeared to be similar to the hair of another boyfriend Stacy had in Corpus Christi, who was the father of the child that she had put up for adoption about 4 years earlier when she was 15. He was later eliminated as a suspect when his alibi placed him at a family event the evening of the murder. There are several problems with the forensics in this case, and I will get to all of that. For now, we're just going to keep going with what was presented at trial. And I will talk more about other past boyfriends in Stacy's life later on as well. Now, because of the way Stacy was found, all things pointed to Stacy having suffered a sexual assault. Dr. Bayardo took another vaginal swab, and when he looked at the swabs under the microscope, he saw that there was sperm present, and like Karen Blakely had observed, the sperm were intact with the tails still attached to the head. And because of this, he came to the conclusion that the sperm had been deposited quite recently. In addition to the vaginal swabs, he also took a rectal swab. When he looked at that under the microscope, he noted that several sperm did not have tails. Though he did note that sperm breaks down faster in the rectum than it does in the vagina because of the presence of bacteria. In examining the rectal area, Dr. Bayardo noted that it was dilated and there were some superficial lacerations on the posterior margin or towards the back. Because of this, it was Dr. Bayardo's opinion that this was consistent with penile penetration. But he did not completely rule out the possibility that the presence of the sperm in the anus was the result of having seeped from the vagina. He also opined that based on his knowledge of what he was seeing here, the injury sustained to the anus occurred very close to her time of death, and therefore the anal penetration was not consensual. At this point, the court documents get into a whole bunch of sciencey things involving the DNA, like polymerase chain reaction testing, alpha alleles, etc., etc. But the windup is that the DNA from the vaginal swab and the anal swab came from one person. So based on Dr. Bayardo's finding, from what he was told in terms of the last time Stacy was seen, which was 3 a.m. on Jimmy Fennell's statement, that was the time that she left for work, and 5:23 a.m., based on the time the truck was discovered in the parking lot, he said that she was likely killed at 3 in the morning. But again, keep in mind, none of that is based on the findings at the time of the autopsy. He based that on Jimmy Fennell's word. When the forensics team processed the truck and the carbon copy checks that belonged to Fennell outside the truck, nothing useful in the way of evidence was found. The prints found inside the truck came only from Stacy and Jimmy Fennell. Other prints were too smudged to be identifiable. No blood or semen was found inside the vehicle either. The saliva or mucus substance found on the carpet covering the transmission hump was also collected, but there was otherwise nothing inside the truck that would have been useful in identifying the killer. It was noted at the time that the mucus in the truck did appear to look similar to the mucus that had come out of Stacy's nose and into her hair. The lab technicians observed the driver's seat of the truck was in a reclined position and that the driver's seatbelt was fastened. And by the way the lap portion of the belt was situated, it appeared as though someone sat on top of the belted buckle. They wanted to test whether or not it was possible to pull a person from the vehicle while the seatbelt was fastened. So Karen Blakely, whose height and weight was similar to Stacy's, got into the driver's seat with the seatbelt on, and one of her colleagues, as well as lead investigator Ranger Wardlow, took turns pulling her from the vehicle by both the feet and the shoulders, and with each try, they were able to pull her from the truck. Also, one of the technicians, who was 6'2" or 1.88 meters tall, sat in the driver's seat, and in looking in the rearview mirror, it was set in a position where he could clearly see out the back window, meaning the last person likely to drive the truck was probably a man around his height and not Stacy, who was not that tall. When the crime lab was finished processing the truck, it was given back to Jimmy. According to court documents, he immediately took it back to the dealership and traded it for another vehicle. I believe this happened about 3 days after Stacy's death. That's how quickly they released the vehicle back to him, and at this point, he was their main suspect. Why would they do that? I have no idea, but just add that to the growing list of troubling things in this investigation, because in doing so, officials essentially eliminated any possibility in the future when someone is charged with Stacy's murder for the defendant and his defense team and experts to have a first-hand look at the vehicle and have testing of their own done. It seems like not the best decision-making here in returning the vehicle to Jimmy Fennell, and it certainly does not look good that he got rid of it so quickly to get something new. The argument can be made that hanging on to the truck would be way too upsetting, and yes, I absolutely agree with that sentiment. But here's the thing. Jimmy Fennell is a cop. He knows the value of forensic evidence and how important it would be to make sure everything possible has been done to ensure if and when a suspect is taken into custody, only then would they have DNA, fingerprints, and hair to possibly match to evidence inside the truck. Yes, the evidence was collected. Investigators should have held onto the truck anyway. Fennell, in the interest of potentially identifying Stacy's killer in the future, should have been the second line of defense in preserving the evidence here. But he didn't. And not only that, he got rid of it quickly. So I ask this. Who is the one person in this world who would benefit the most from getting rid of the crime scene? The killer. Jimmy Fennell also knew the value of getting rid of evidence. And it is likely he was given his truck back so quickly because he was a police officer. Investigators were not able to arrest anyone in the days and weeks and months following Stacy's murder. For nearly a year, they focused on digging into people Stacy knew, the people who were in her circle. HEB put up a reward for $50,000 for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible for her death. And this garnered a steady stream of tips and leads, some of which did provide some useful information, such as information that was called in by a newspaper delivery person. He said when he drove by the site where Stacy's body was left on Bluebonnet Drive at 4 a.m., the body was not there. Now, that tip doesn't really mean much in my opinion, because a gentleman who found Stacy had specifically gone off the road to pick flowers and discovered her among some brush down in a ditch. If you're driving by delivering newspapers, you're probably not looking down into the ditch. You're looking at driveways and tossing your newspapers, and it was still dark. I don't know how well lit the area was, but a listener in our group, like I said, described the area as rural. As the investigation wore on, hundreds of people were interviewed, and this included people Stacy had gone to high school with, previous boyfriends or guys that she dated, and her circle of friends and people she worked with at HEB. Almost 30 men were at some point persons of interest in Stacy's case. Some right away, some emerged as the investigation went on. Each man was asked to consent to provide blood, hair, and saliva samples. All of them consented except for one, a man named Brian Haynes. And he was the brother of another early suspect in Stacy's killing, but eventually, authorities obtained a search warrant that compelled him to give up the samples. Officer David Hall was also asked for samples. If you recall, he was friends with Fennell and coached Little League with him too. He voluntarily provided the samples. Officer Hall and his wife only lived one block away from Fennell's apartment, and his alibi was he was at home with his wife, Carla Hall, when Stacy disappeared. Ranger Wardlow quickly eliminated Officer Hall due to his DNA not being a match to the semen and because of his alibi. We will be circling back to Carla Hall a little bit later on as we progress through these episodes. The last known person to see Stacy alive was Jimmy Fennell, her fiancé. So he, of course, was a suspect from the beginning. But a few things that should have happened did not happen. He was a suspect. He was the last known person to see Stacy alive, admittedly. Yet the apartment he shared with her was never searched. Not sure why a search of the apartment was never conducted. Maybe it could have been the fact that the truck was thought to be the place where Stacy was killed, and that was the primary crime scene, so searching his apartment was deemed unnecessary. Maybe it was because he was a cop. But it wasn't for a lack of considering him a suspect. Fennell was aggressively interrogated numerous times by Ranger Wardlow and several other investigators on the case with the Bastrop Police Department. Fennell also voluntarily provided his blood sample, and despite the fact that this testing of his DNA excluded him as the donor of the semen found in Stacy, they tried to build a case against him anyway. They tried to investigate the possible other means of transportation Fennell could have used in order for him to have been involved. They ruled out him having used Carol's Ford Tempo because he had to get the keys from her on the morning of the 23rd when he left in her car to go looking for Stacy. But to me, that doesn't necessarily eliminate the possibility that Fennell had a key to Carol's apartment himself. It's likely, you know, I still have keys to my mom's house, and it's for emergency purposes. So who's to say that if he needed the Ford that night, that he didn't quietly open the door and lift the keys from where they're kept and use the car? We really don't know for sure. Ranger Wardlow investigated taxi companies to see if anyone had a fare that night or early in the morning. He checked the mileage on all the cars that belonged to the Giddings Police Department, but nothing panned out. Now, if for some reason somebody from the Giddings Police Department was thought to have given Fennell a ride home from the crime scene, they only checked the police cars. I mean, who's to say that any one of them could have used their own personal vehicle to give Fennell a ride? So that was never thoroughly investigated either. And of course, Jimmy Fennell would not have had the time to walk the 35 miles or 56 kilometers from Bastrop to his apartment. The tenants of the apartment complex were questioned as to whether or not they saw or heard anything that night or early morning, but nobody was awake at the time. Though Stacy's mom did say that she heard one set of footsteps going down the stairs at 3 in the morning. Who that was, we can't say for sure, but it seems as though the investigation assumed that it was Stacy leaving for work. Eventually, Jimmy Fennell was eliminated as a suspect as no evidence could be found to support him having anything to do with Stacy's murder. But for me, because Stacy was last seen in her apartment, because Jimmy Fennell himself said he and Stacy were alone in the apartment beginning from the evening before when he returned from the Little League game until she left at 3 in the morning to drive to work, the fact that their apartment wasn't ever searched is incredibly troubling. And it is my opinion that that fact alone is enough to throw everything else in this case into question. How do you not search the last known place Stacy was? That's like police investigation 101. Even the prosecutor on this case years later would say something along the lines of, there are things that don't get done that should have gotten done in every case. And for this case, this is that thing. You think? Now, I want to take a few minutes and talk about Investigator Ed Salmela. He was with the Bastrop Police Department at the time of Stacy's murder, and he was involved in the investigation. But a little more than 3 months after Stacy's murder, Salmela became a suspect in her murder. You see, on August 1st, 1996, Ed Salmela was fired from the Bastrop Police Department after having been on the force for 12 years. The reasons why he was fired has never been revealed. I asked around in a couple of Facebook groups dedicated to this case if anybody ever found out why Ed Salmela was fired, and nobody seems to know. 2 days later, on August 3rd, 1996, Ed Salmela was found dead in the apartment that he shared at the time with the lead investigator on the case, Ranger Wardlow. Yes, Investigator Ed Salmela and Texas Ranger Wardlow were roommates at the time, and that is how he came to be the one to find him dead. Once Salmela wound up dead, this prompted Ranger Wardlow to add him to the list of suspects in Stacy's murder. Why that is, I'm not sure, but I can't help but think that Salmela's death was related to his firing from the police department, and that his firing was related to Stacy's murder investigation. I mean, why else would he end up on the suspect list immediately after his firing and subsequent death? At the time, though, Jimmy Fennell was still the prime suspect. Salmela's death was quickly ruled as a suicide by Ranger Wardlow. He had apparently shot himself, though an examination of his body revealed that he had no gunshot residue on his hands. And I believe Salmela was shot through the left side of his head, but he was right-handed. So that's another reason why this suicide is considered suspicious. The basis for Wardlow declaring this a suicide, according to him, is that there was evidence of a suicide note near his body, apparently written by an unnamed girlfriend, and it said that Ed Salmela was distraught over their relationship. This detail bothers me so much. Because why in the world would his girlfriend write his own suicide note? The only reason I could think that this would be a thing in the investigation is if it was an attempt to cover up the fact that the note was not written by Salmela himself. That perhaps he would not have written a suicide note because he didn't kill himself? That is a big, huge red flag for me here. So there are some questions swirling as to whether or not Ed Salmela's death was a suicide. So I'll most likely be referring to it from this point forward as his death or as his purported suicide. Because you see, an hour before he supposedly killed himself, Salmela dropped off some clothing at a laundry facility and told the clerk that he would be back in an hour to pick it up. And he also told the clerk that he was getting ready to go to Louisiana to do some gambling. He had also taken out $600 from an ATM, and that money was later found in his car. It wasn't too long after Salmela's death that Ranger Wardlow dropped both him and his prime suspect, Jimmy Fennell, from his suspect list. When Wardlow was questioned as to why he dropped Fennell, his answer was one word: logistics. I cannot for the life of me understand what the hell that means. But when you take the word for what it is, logistics, it could mean the management of the case, it could mean a strategy, it could be a plan. It sounds like the manner in which he was directing the case. It feels like he's running it how he wants to run it by his own logistics. I don't know. I do think that Ranger Wardlow owed the public a better answer than that, but whatever. And Ed Salmela would not be the only officer with ties to this case that would wind up dead under suspicious circumstances, and we will get to that a little bit later. Now, An hour after Ed Samala's supposed suicide, a woman named Iris Lindsay, who was a friend of Samala's but also a neighbor of the Reed family, her granddaughter was shot in the leg, ostensibly by a drive-by shooter. We have not mentioned the Reeds yet up to this point, but they will definitely come up later on in this case, and so will Iris. No one has officially connected the two shootings other than the fact that they happened within an hour of each other, but people still wonder about it, and it will become a little more clear later on. Remember Iris's name. She's going to come up in a few minutes when we get to the Reed family. So back to Samela having been quickly made a suspect in Stacy's murder following his death. He was just as quickly removed from the list of suspects because there was apparently really nothing that pointed to him having any involvement in it. There did not seem to be a connection between Samela or Fennell or with Officer Hall either, Fennell's friend, other than the fact that all three men were police officers. But Ranger Wardlow did call for a blood sample to be drawn from Samela at the time of his autopsy, and that was sent for the lab testing. It is believed that Ranger Wardlow did this in order to be able to deflect any speculation that Samela's death was in some way related to Stacy's murder by showing that he had been DNA tested and eliminated as a donor of the semen found in Stacy. Eventually, all of the suspects Ranger Wardlow had at the time, about 24 of them, were all eliminated by way of DNA testing. By the way, Ed Salmela's DNA will come up in this case later on. So closing in on about a year after Stacy's death, investigators on the case eventually received information that led them to a suspect. His name is Rodney Reed, an African-American man who happened to live about 0.6 mile away from Bastrop High School, where Stacy's truck was found abandoned. Several of Rodney's family members and friends and his girlfriend also lived close by in Bastrop. I heard one report that said he became a suspect following an arrest involving a drug charge, that he sold drugs. But in the court documents, the way that I read it is that Rodney was often seen by Bastrop police officers walking in the area near his home late at night or very early in the morning. From 1995 to 1997, Rodney worked a night shift, and at least two officers reported regularly seeing Rodney walking along the railroad tracks near his house. This is what prompted an investigation into Rodney. Because of his frequency in the area and the proximity of his house to the location where the truck was abandoned. From very early on in the investigation, authorities thought that the location of where the truck was left, which was roughly 6 miles or so, or 9.66 kilometers away from where Stacy's body was left, would have been a place convenient for the person who killed Stacy. So investigators contacted the crime lab to see if Rodney had a DNA sample on file in the database, which they did. So a comparison was made between Rodney's DNA and the DNA swabbed from Stacy, and it came back as a match. So Rodney Reed was taken into custody. He was given his Miranda rights, but he was not told about the DNA findings. He waived his rights and provided a written statement that said in part, "I don't know Stacy Stites, never seen her other than what's on the news. The only thing I do know is what was said on the news that she was murdered." Okay, so investigators had a warrant to obtain a blood sample from Rodney, and that was sent over to the lab. And again, his DNA was matched to evidence found on Stacy. I don't think I mentioned that it was not only semen, but also some saliva on her breast as well. With this very damning evidence, in May of 1997, Rodney Reed was charged with capital murder. Now, Rodney's defense was going to be two-pronged. They were first going to try and establish that someone else killed Stacy, possibly Jimmy Fennell, her fiancé, or possibly another man named David LaHone. But I'm not going to discuss David LaHone because at this point, from what is known now, that aspect of his defense is irrelevant. Second, the defense is going to need to establish that Rodney, contrary to what he said in his initial written statement when he was first taken into custody, he was now saying that he did, in fact, have a clandestine romantic relationship with Stacy, and that this is the reason why his semen was present in her body. They had recently had consensual sexual intercourse. So the defense needed to prove this because, you know, Rodney had lied in the beginning. But his defense team was going to have a huge problem. Nobody was really willing to step up and say they had knowledge of their relationship. Rodney's mom, early on, I believe in a preliminary hearing, testified that she was aware that Rodney was seeing Stacy. But at trial, remember the name Iris Lindley? The one whose granddaughter was shot in the leg an hour after Ed Salmela was found dead? She was called to the stand by Rodney's defense to provide testimony on his behalf. She was a neighbor of Rodney's, and she testified to an incident where she was sitting on the porch of the Reed house talking with his mother, Sandra, in early 1996. A young woman with brown hair pulled up to the house driving a gray truck. She approached them on the porch and asked if Rodney was home. Sandra told her that he wasn't, so she said to Sandra to tell Rodney that Stephanie came by. Later, Iris clarified that the name was either Stacy or Stephanie. When Iris was shown a picture of Stacy, she said that Stacy did look like the young woman who had come by Rodney's house. In her testimony on direct examination, she did say that it was her impression that Stacy and Rodney were dating, but when she was cross-examined, she admitted that she had no real knowledge of that. Other than that, if anyone knew of any relationship between Rodney and Stacy, none of them were willing to come forward. That all would change in the ensuing years, and we will revisit this aspect of the case as well. When it came to Fennell as a possible suspect in Stacy's killing, Rodney's defense spent a great deal of time pointing out the many missteps made in the investigation when looking into Fennell. They pointed to the fact that almost all of the information provided to law enforcement about where Stacy was prior to her death, her routines, her habits, and the items that were found in the truck was all provided to investigators by Fennell himself. And the biggest point they wanted to drive home was the fact that they never searched the apartment that he and Stacy shared, thereby eliminating any possibility of ever uncovering any kind of evidence inside the apartment that may have implicated Fennell. Also, there was no physical or forensic evidence inside the truck that connected Rodney to it. There were none of his fingerprints, no hairs, no fibers, no DNA, except for the DNA found in her body. The prosecution would say that Rodney wiped down his fingerprints before abandoning the vehicle. But of course, we would counter that by saying, how is it he managed to magically wipe away his fingerprints, but not Stacy's or Fennell's, which were found in places where fingerprints would normally be found? A friend of Stacy's named Tammy Renee Haneth, they went to high school together. She took the stand and testified that based on what she knew and what Stacy had told her, Jimmy Fennell was very controlling and possessive. There was an occasion when she was on the phone with Stacy making plans for Stacy to come to Smithville to visit. And during that conversation, Fennell came home. Stacy told him about her plans to visit Tammy. And shortly thereafter, everything became quiet and the phone disconnected. Okay, Dreamers, I'm going to go off of the court documents for a second and talk about what is going on here with Stacy, Jimmy Fennell, and Rodney Reed. We are going to get to more information about Stacy and her relationships, ones from the past, because it did have an impact on her relationship with Jimmy Fennell. But it all depends on who you're asking. Stacy was engaged to Fennell, and it all seemed to happen pretty quickly. She was only 19 years old at the time, which for some is a little bit young to get married. Fennell was young too, I believe about 3 or 4 years older than Stacy though. And like I said, they became engaged relatively fast. Stacy was a pretty girl, and she had dated several young men prior to becoming engaged to Fennell. And as I had mentioned earlier, she had become pregnant when she was 15 with her then boyfriend, but she gave that child up for adoption. She did remain in contact with the father of that baby, even up to the time she became engaged to Jimmy Fennell, and according to several reports, Fennell was jealous of the relationships that Stacy maintained with previous romantic partners. Some say he had a pretty bad temper and he was very controlling over Stacy. Some even later reporting that he even said that if he ever caught Stacy cheating on him, he would kill her, and he'd do it by strangling her with a belt. And it is believed that Jimmy Fennell did become aware that Stacy was seeing Rodney and even confronted him and threatened him. And I will get into more details about that confrontation a little later. Now, I did hear a report that Stacy found out that she was pregnant in February of 1996, which is thought to have been a reason why Stacy and Fennell were so quick to become engaged and want to get married, but she ended up having a miscarriage. I may or may not come back to this point because I'm not sure if it's true or not. If I find out more information as I go along, I will definitely address this possible pregnancy again later. But if you talk to Stacy's family, her sisters specifically, they will insist that Stacy was in love with Jimmy Fennell and she was looking forward to marriage and was very much enjoying planning the wedding. And from what I had presented in the beginning of this episode, it kind of sounds like she was. Do I think her sisters are embellishing things? No, I don't, not at all. I believe that is what they believe. And who would know Stacy better than her own sisters? But I can't help wonder, why Rodney, if she was truly happy and excited about her impending marriage to Jimmy Fennell? Well, to that, Stacy's sisters would say, never, not a chance in hell, would Stacy have anything to do with Rodney Reed. His semen was found in her body because he raped her and then he killed her. Acknowledging Stacy would carry on an affair with Rodney would, to them, cast somewhat of a negative light on Stacy's character. She was engaged. Jimmy Fennell had a pretty good start in life. With his career in law enforcement, it was budding. Why would Stacy associate herself with a person like Rodney Reed? He had a criminal history, including numerous charges of sexual assault. And I am by no means attempting to paint Rodney Reed as a pillar of the community. But that does not mean Stacy wouldn't have anything to do with a guy like that. She was engaged to the guy who was on the right side of the law, wasn't she? Yeah, she was. It was clear she knew and understood where the stable future would be, with Jimmy Fennell. That would be the right choice, the correct choice, the proper choice, the choice that her family would approve of, the one that looked best on paper. And maybe Rodney was just someone to have fun with. And many people, I believe as many as 20 people would come forward in the subsequent years to attest to the fact that Stacy was seeing Rodney and openly talked about it with coworkers and some of her family members. I believe she would feel compelled to hide her relationship with Rodney from her mom and her sisters because they would not approve of her behavior. In an interview I watched on Crime Watch Daily with Stacy's sisters, you can feel the disgust and the vitriol that they have towards Rodney Reed. Of course they believe he killed their sister, so naturally they would feel that way towards him. But I would not put it past them to share the same sentiments about Rodney if they were in the know about Stacy's sexual affair with him, which is why Stacy would have never told them. Remember Stacy just 4 years earlier when she was barely in high school, got pregnant with her boyfriend at the time and gave the baby up for adoption. We can't know for sure how supportive her sisters and her mom were. We know that she was close to her mom, so much so that they lived in the same apartment complex. Her mom moved with Stacy when she moved to live with Fennell outside of Giddings to be closer to him and his work. But it goes without saying, there is a certain range of emotions when it comes to your young teenage daughter and sister getting pregnant. There can be disappointment, anger, fear, sadness on the part of her mother and her sisters. But eventually, the pregnancy has to be dealt with. And because Stacy chose adoption, I can imagine that her family eventually would come around and be supportive of her through it all. And once it's over, they can put it behind them and move forward. And so, I just don't think her family would have been pleased at all if they found out she was not being faithful to her relationship with Jimmy Fennell. Again, I want to reiterate, this is only my opinion. But I can see her family being delighted that she is settling down with a seemingly nice young man with a budding career in law enforcement. This would be the man who would take care of Stacy, to provide for her, to protect her, to give her a stable future. If I had a sister, I would want that for her, for sure. Anybody would. And because of that, if Fennell was being controlling, possessive, and possibly abusive behind closed doors, is that something that she is going to want to share with her mom and her sisters? No matter how close she was with them, if they are happy and excited for her upcoming marriage to this guy, is she going to want to throw that all away by opening up about what was truly going on behind closed doors? Maybe not. Everyone appeared to be so caught up in the wedding planning. There was so much excitement about it. And let me talk about that for a moment. I'm not completely convinced that Stacy was looking forward to marrying Jimmy Fennell. Of course, I didn't know Stacy. I can only formulate some opinions based on what people have had to say about her. But I think she had gotten in so deep, it was coming down to the wire. The date was quickly approaching. How could she turn back now? People get cold feet. But did she really want to disappoint everyone? I don't know. When everyone has gone through so much to make this day perfect for you, and it's supposed to be a big church wedding, I mean, how is she supposed to roll back on everything at the last minute? And then, I don't know about you guys listening, but I've had a couple of girlfriends who over the years dreamed of planning their lavish weddings. I mean, for some, it's one of the biggest and most important events. They immerse themselves into the planning of the thing. And I've had at least one friend who put on a huge wedding and was divorced in under a year. We were convinced that she really wanted the wedding, but not the marriage. I think lots of people kind of think the same thing about Kim Kardashian when she married basketball player Chris Humphries. The wedding became this entire storyline in her reality show. The planning took longer than the actual marriage lasted, right? I can't say for certain that Stacy had this mindset, but it is a thing that some brides get carried away with, which may explain her enthusiasm about making the arrangements. Again, wanting the wedding, but not the marriage. And how would Jimmy Fennell react to that? If the reports about him are accurate, he is not going to handle her calling off the wedding very well, like at all. He's been described as possessive and controlling. Putting a ring on it and getting married to her could be a part of that. Maybe Stacy was feeling a little bit trapped, a little bit cornered. And maybe the fling with Rodney was a component of that. A distraction. Something new and different and fun before she was officially married and then she would have to settle down. Maybe. She certainly isn't the first person to have these mixed feelings, and she certainly won't be the last. But the one thing that I don't want us to do, I don't want any of us to do this, is to pass any judgment on the choices that Stacy made, because none of us are perfect. And she was absolutely free to make the choices that she made. They may not have been the best or the healthiest choices, but Stacy did what she did for herself, for her own reasons, and I don't want to question or judge her on that. No matter what she did, no matter what anyone thinks of what she did, she did not deserve what happened to her. Dreamers, this case seemed to hinge on whether or not Rodney Reed and Stacy Stites had a consensual sexual relationship. As a matter of fact, the only thing that really tied Rodney to this crime was his semen being present. But the more I looked into this case over the last week, since it was brought up in our discussion group, the more I have found myself moving away from the consensual relationship between Rodney and Stacy being the make or break factor in this case. As a matter of fact, I've just about reached a point where, in terms of who killed Stacy Stites is concerned, a relationship between her and Rodney is pretty much irrelevant. I have pretty much come to the conclusion that Rodney Reed's innocence can be proven whether you believe they had a relationship or not. And the answers this time are not necessarily in the DNA. Though some conclusions have been made that contradict what was presented to the jury that convicted Rodney when it comes to the DNA, the semen specifically, the sperm, the number of sperm found, and the fact that they were still intact. And I will talk all about this in the upcoming parts of the story. But to find the answers as to who killed Stacy, we have to nail down the time that Stacy died and who she was with when she died. And those answers are going to be found in the science, in the forensics. Because Stacy's body told a story, but the people examining the story that she had to tell may very well have misinterpreted, misunderstood, misrepresented, misconstrued, and possibly misled everyone. Most importantly, the jury who ended up convicting Rodney Reed and sentencing him to death. And that is a wrong that needs to be made right before the state of Texas puts Rodney Reed to death. I'm going to go ahead and end part one here, and if all goes well, this series will be delivered to you the same way that I was able to bring you the four parts in Kevin Cooper's case a few episodes back. There is another level of urgency here with Rodney's case because he is scheduled to die, unlike Kevin. So I will hopefully have the subsequent parts to this all out for you in just a few short days. If you are familiar with Rodney's case and you would like to help, there is a petition out there on change.org to stop the execution of Rodney Reed, and I will post that in the group. There are also a number of Facebook groups dedicated to Rodney's innocence, and I've joined one called Rodney Reed, Innocent on Texas Death Row. I've been communicating with one of the admins of the page who has been so kind as to offer to answer any questions I have as I go through this case. On that page, you can find all the updates and documents related to Rodney's case, but I have to warn you, the court documents are extensive, and I'm doing my best to go through it all with some semblance of organization, but I have to admit, when it comes to the facts, they're all over the place, and I feel like I'm looking in 100 different directions to make sure I'm getting this right. And if I do make a mistake, please message me so I can add it in the corrections in subsequent episodes. I will save my usual closing for the very last episode so you won't have to hear it over and over again. So dreamers, stay tuned for part two. Until next time, sweet dreams.